Juliet Dogcast Radio. If you like dogs, wherever you are in the world, we're the show for you. Hello and welcome to episode 287 of Dogcast Radio, which is all about dogs of the world. Specifically, Lily Chin's great new book, Dogs of the World, an illustrated compendium. Later in the Dogcast Radio news, we'll be hearing which breeds are most likely to get into trouble. Is your favourite breed on there? Mine is. Talking of breeds, how many can you name? Do you know how they originated, what their original purpose was? And hang on, what do we even mean by the word breed? This is the kind of issue Lily Chin gets to grips with in her latest book, where she also illustrates breeds of the world with her inimitable, charming drawings. I'll be honest with you, I love this book.
Both as a child and as an adult, I love books like this that just show you and tell you about so many breeds because I can imagine what life would be like with them. And I love it. Do you like books like that yourself?
Me too. I absolutely love books like that. And I mean, one of the reasons I did this book was because I love drawing dogs and I love looking at books with dog breeds in them. So this is the kind of book that I would have loved to have had as a child.
Yeah, definitely. I would love to sit there and sort of go through them and decide which one I'd want. And some days it would be a Pyrenean Mountain dog, and other days it might be a Cocker Spaniel, you know, or Skipperky, or, you know, all kinds of some. Yeah. So, but this was a mammoth undertaking, wasn't it? So what did spark it?
Okay, so it was a mammoth undertaking because it took about 10 years. I mean, I really had only about a year to write and illustrate this book, but most of the illustrations started over 10 years ago. So I work as a pet portrait artist. That's one of the things I do. I draw people's dogs and cats. And for the first few years that I was a pet portrait artist, believe it or not, I didn't really know anything about breeds. So people would send me photos of their dogs to draw, and I would draw them from the photos without necessarily knowing what breeds they were. And around like 2014 or so, I started becoming interested. I thought I should know what breeds are. You know, I'm a dog artist. And I became fascinated by the fact that dog breeds came from different countries, that dog breeds had nationalities. And I started going down all these rabbit holes on the internet looking up which breed came from which country. And you know, I just became obsessed. and then I wanted to draw all these dogs. There were so many of them. And I started creating a series of posters called Dogs of the World, which is kind of the genesis of this book. At first, there were like just over 100 dogs that I'd drawn from different parts of the world, organized in different posters by their geographical regions of origin. And then these posters went viral on the internet. I got a lot of feedback from people. A lot of the feedback I got was something like, oh, you missed the rough collie, or you missed the whatever breed, or where is the and I thought, okay, there are so many more dogs I need to learn about. So 2018 I created a new poster, and this had 366 dog breeds on it, including mixers and village dogs and other types of dogs that aren't generally known as breeds. And this was kind of an amazing project. So in the book, there are over 600 breeds, but about half of these were done back in 2018. So, yeah, I would say it's a 10-year project.
That's interesting because when I'm not comparing myself to you at all, but when I've written something, I can't draw at all, but when I've written something, when I go back and look at it after a while, bits I kind of cringe and go, what was I doing there? And bits I go, oh, yeah, I got that bit right. Was it like that with the drawings? Because you'd done them so long ago. Did you sort of see what was good and what was bad?
Yeah.
Well, not bad. That's the wrong word. But, you know.
Oh, definitely. I mean, I had to redo some of them. I mean, if I had another, like, 5 years on this book, I would have redone all of them. But, yeah. I would have redrawn everything. I mean, I also did sort of sometime in the past few years, I also did visit a dog show, and I met a lot of dogs in real life that previously I'd only seen on the internet. And seeing dogs, meeting dogs in real life, again, brought a whole new perspective. You can see coat texture, and you can see sizes, which is something that doesn't come across very well on in photos on the internet, like the relative sizes between dog breeds. So the more I learned, the more I wanted to redo my drawings. So I think that's just going to be something I'm always going to be feeling, you know, this need to revise.
Yeah, that's because you're a perfectionist. I mean, to us, to me, they look wonderful already, but I know with your own, with one's own work, you're always sort of looking at, oh, I want to tweak that, I want to do that. But yeah, I mean, it's
I could
wonderful.
Tweak endlessly.
Now, you say that about meeting them and sort of understanding the character. I can remember the first time I went to a Great Dane show and this huge dog came towards me and I sort of braced and thought, I thought of Buddy. And I thought, oh, I'm about to be Labradored by a dog the size of a Great Dane. Oh, my goodness. And I kind of braced for impact. And this Great Dane just walked up, sniffed me and kind of went, you may adore me. Yes. And I was like, oh, wow, this is a completely different, you know, the nature of this dog is completely different. And I love that because you do capture the character as well as the physical traits. So I wanted to talk to you sort of about that process. How do you start the drawings? Like, do you concentrate on appearance or, you know, how do you research? Do you try and meet them all? And what's the balance of the actual appearance and the character?
Right. Okay. So I did concentrate on appearances because it is mostly an illustrated book. And the little histories that are attached to every breed that I've drawn, I did read up about those. I mean, I looked up books. I looked up, you know, the FCI breed standards and Wikipedia and whatever I could find. But I did focus on visual appearances. And I would, well, so for example, if I was researching a certain breed, like a more obscure breed, I would try and find as many photos as I could on Instagram, on through Google, and then just to get a sense of the different varieties and coat colors and coat types. And then I would pick the images I liked best and I would draw from those as my reference.
Yeah. You do a fantastic job. I mean, they look like the breed, but you do capture the character of the little German Spitz. It's just so, like, ah, Missy is so cheerful and it's just, you know, tail up and come on, world.
I wanted them to look as cheerful as possible.
Yeah. They're beautiful. They're beautiful. Were there any? Because I was fascinated, I can't draw at all. And so this process fascinates me. Were there any that were difficult to draw in terms, you know, either artistically or in terms of sort of doing justice to their character?
That's a really good question. So I think if I had drawn these dogs realistically in a realistic style, that, you know, a photorealistic style, it would have been an easier task for me because I chose to draw them in a very flat, simple, minimalist style. The challenge was to make these drawings look different enough from each other. So in my research, I found that there were a lot of dog breeds that looked very similar. As you know, Airedale Terrier, Welsh Terrier, you know.
Yes, yeah.
They look very similar. And then you've got all those white fluffy dogs that look very similar from all around the world. And then there are all the black and tan scent hound looking dogs that look very similar. So the challenge for me was to not make them look the same.
Yes, yeah. And I hadn't noticed that, but yes.
Yeah, so I had to, I did look at a lot of photos and then I had to try my best to draw in such a way that I would not be drawing the same dog.
Yes, yeah. Yes, absolutely. And did you then ask people that know about the breed, you know, that are very familiar with it to sort of check the drawings?
Yeah. So interestingly, it was not easy to find somebody who knew all the breeds to be able to check all. Like, I mean, people have their favorite breeds or their specialties, so they know certain breeds. And I didn't really have time to approach like 600 people to check every type of dog. But I had the benefit of some really like amazing individuals. Like I have an Instagram friend, Chris Nelson. He's a dog show announcer with the AKC and the UKC. Yeah. So he has an amazing encyclopedic knowledge of dog breeds. So he was one of my checkers. He could tell me, like, okay, you know, about certain coat colors or that were more common, or you could, you know, give me little notes. And then I also consulted with Craig Koshik, who's a historian of pointing dog breeds. I mean, that's gun dogs. So he checked my gun dog pages and would sort of give me little notes on coloring. And then I, Rajashree Kalap from India, she's like a specialist in primitive type dogs, like village dogs. And she could check what I'd written about those dogs. So I had different people who had their area of knowledge and expertise that I could ask for notes.
Yeah, perfect, perfect. What kind of feedback have you had? And what really interests me is when, you know, I went to look at the Labrador and the German Spitz and the Bichon and the Papillon, you know, and the dogs that we have to go, yeah, you got them, you know, and I was so happy with them. They're beautiful. So what kind of, is that what most people do?
I think it's really, it's just so funny to me. That's the first thing everyone does when they pick up the book is they look for their dog. I mean, I would do the same.
Oh, it's super. And it, I mean, we, from this book, we learned so much about breeds, but like you've learned so much about breeds, haven't you, doing this?
Yeah. Well, as I said, like in the beginning, I didn't know anything. I thought breeds were just dogs that looked a certain way. They had a specific look. And then in delving deeper, I learned how breeds were created by people. And I think that's something that a lot of people don't know. They don't realize that breeds are human inventions. They're social constructions that we create. We design them. We decide on, you know, which parts of their cultural history goes into their standard, which parts of their temperament. I mean, we decide what temperament we want them to have. Yeah. You know, there are so many stories associated with a breed that they're sort of like fascinating to read about or, that are used to promote a certain breed. But everything is decided by us. I just think that's amazing.
Yeah absolutely. And I guess the variety of breeds that we have now reflects the variety of jobs we want them to do and preferences we have about, you know.
Yeah,
you know, I for example, I love a sporty looking short coated dog, whereas Jenny is, my daughter is into sort of fluffy looking dogs.
Yeah,
but we are into these, and that's reflects how we've changed them. But yeah, I mean, to go back to the beginning, how did breeds come about? Because you talk about village dogs, human selection, land races. I mean, it's fascinating, but how did they come about?
So I guess a very general timeline, which is what's in the book, is that dogs started out as village dogs. And I use the term village dogs in that sense to mean that they weren't standardized. They were created by nature. The way they look was designed by nature, by geography. Like, you know, dogs in colder climates, they look wolfish, they're fluffy, thick-coated dogs. And then in subtropical climates where it's really warm, you have short-coated dogs that are skinny, that, you know, are well adapted to the heat. So dogs, my understanding is that over time in the past, you know, 15,000 years or more, people have, you know, selectively bred the dogs that they like, for either for temperament, personality, looks, working ability, and different types have co-evolved with people over time. But then it wasn't until the 19th century in Victorian England that the word breed was used, and that's when dogs, these different types of dogs, acquired standards, like official national standards, that they should be this tall, they should weigh this much, these specific coat colors, this specific temperament. So the breeds that we, you know, when we talk about breeds, most people are thinking of pedigree dogs or purebred dogs. So these are the dogs that we've created, and they're only about 250 years old. In my book, however, in the gallery chapter of my book, I have drawn a whole range of dogs, most of which are not recognized as breeds by kennel clubs. And I did intentionally want to do that because I want to show that, you know, in other parts of the world, you know, breed is kind of used, the term breed is used quite differently. It isn't necessarily a purebred or a pedigree dog that is part of a system. It could be a working type of dog. It could be a mix. It could be a village dog, and so on.
Yeah. Because, I mean, you asked that question. You say, what is a breed anyway? I mean, it's very relevant because nowadays we're having, you know, Cavapoos, Cabochons, poodles being crossed with everything, you know. And you do, I mean, I don't know. I know nothing. But some people have expressed a lot of concern to me about some of the crosses. But that's presumably how it came about in the first place. And I don't like snobbery around sort of purebreds or not. But, I mean, it is very relevant, isn't it? Because we need to sort of, you know, we've got these, like a Springer door, you know, a Labrador Springer cross. And in the old days, we just said Labrador Springer cross. They've got these names. So we are playing with the idea of breeds, aren't we?
We are. And it's not a definition that is set in stone. It really depends on who you talk to. It depends on which group of people you talk to and what their emotional investment is in dogs. So for me, I'm not a breeder. I don't even have a dog right now. I don't feel like I'm in any position to judge whether a certain type of dog is a breed or not a breed. It's not for me to say, but I have heard that, you know, these crossbred dogs are also considered breeds by some people. I mean, I don't know.
Yeah, I guess the thing is, my issue with it is, if it's a recognized breed, you can assume, and you maybe, you know, you still have to do your due diligence with any breeder, but you can assume that there are health tests in place and that there's some kind of breed standard, so you know roughly, you know, what you're getting, and the health tests for me are important. Whereas if it's not officially recognized, that's my main concern, is how are we regulating this? Is it just people sort of crossing dogs that look cute and getting lots of money and exploiting dogs, basically? That's my sort of line in the sand. You know, are they being looked after or exploited?
So I did originally have a chapter in this book on how to buy a dog from an ethical dog breeder. That didn't make it the book, but I do offer it as a free infographic from my website. And I think the line, where you draw the line between whether a breed is ethical or not kind of varies depending on who you are. But my understanding is that, you know, ethical breeders do not necessarily have to be registered with a kennel club. It's more in how they treat their dogs. It's more in the health testing, like what is the environment like for the parent dogs? Do they know the parent dogs? I guess it's a much more intimate process. How they connect with their buyers, and, you know, well, unethical breeders are the ones who don't care who they sell puppies to.
Yeah, yeah.
And puppies end up in shelters, rescues.
Yeah. I mean, I urge people to sort of get your chapter on how to choose, because it is really important. It's a huge decision. It's really easy to assume people will be nice or people will be ethical, or, you know, and to be hugely disappointed. So it's really important. I mean, also I would say, whether you buy from a breeder or whether you adopt from a shelter, from a rescue, you still need to do research and make sure this is an ethical rescue or shelter.
Of course.
So when we talk about breeds nowadays, do you think it's you know, whether it's a breed like a pure breed or a mix, it's quite a useful shorthand, isn't it? Because, you know, if I see a Labrador or a Labrador cross, I'll kind of go, I know that it's hopefully it's going to be quite a soft dog and energetic and fun. But, you know, having said that, do you think it's important that we bear in mind that breed tendencies are just that, they're tendencies, and dogs will be individuals?
Yeah, breed tendencies are just that. It depends on, breed is just a very small factor in what a dog's personality is like. There's genetics, and genetics, as you know, there are different lineages within a breed, and I kind of mentioned that in the book too. Like you could have a Labrador Retriever who's come from a service lineage, or you could have a Labrador Retriever from a gun dog lineage, or a assistance dog, or it really depends on that dog's family genetics. So you can end up with Labrador retrievers all being the same breed but having very different temperaments. So you can't really just use breed to predict what a dog's going to be like. And then on top of that, there's the environment that they're raised in and their individual family history and you know, the people they're living with and the lifestyle.
Yeah, yeah. I think sometimes some breeds must have better PR people because, you know, but you know what I mean? People will say, oh, I wouldn't have a blah. I won't say any specific breeds, but they'll say, oh, I would never have a blah because they're sharp or they're loud or whatever it is.
Yeah,
Sometimes it's ones that it's a breed that you've met delightful individuals on.
Exactly. I had a Boston Terrier, Boogie, and he passed away in 2020, but, you know, he was a rescue. And I met a lot of rescued Boston Terriers, and no two Boston Terriers were alike. They were all very different.
Oh, bless. Oh, bless it. I mean, talking about the development of the breeds, one thing that occurred to me, it was very specific. I was looking at page 51. It was about pointing dogs, the origin of breeds. And I just thought, oh my goodness, how did we take a wolf, or whether we took the wolf or whether the wolf took us, but how did we get from the point of the wolf being, you know, its own boss kind of thing? And we took this wolf and we taught it to say to us, hey, the prey is over there.
Okay.
That's where, but then I sort of thought, well, hang on. Is it that we taught them to defer to us and kind of go, oh, your prey is over there? Or did we show them that they can say to us, the prey is over there, you go do the work, I'll just eat the results, you know?
Well, the thing about pointing, and this was amazing to me too, this was something I learned when I was researching the book, is that the behavior of pointing is something that a lot of mammal species do. It's not just dogs. Pointing is that moment, you know, when that freeze, when you see something, which could be a prey or something that interests you and you freeze. A cat's do it, you know, that freeze before the pounce. A lot of point. So it's not unique to pointing dogs. It's something that any dog could do. I mean, my Boston Terrier pointed.
You know? Yes, but yeah.
I guess, you know, people saw this ability, they saw this behavior in their dogs, and they said, I want more of that in my dogs. So they would breed the dogs that pointed, and over time, I mean, I'm not a genetics expert. I don't know what I'm talking about, but behaviors that people like get bred over and over again until they're intensified and exaggerated. And now you have like a lineage of dogs that have a very dramatic pointing behavior. And I don't know if you've seen those YouTube videos of like German Shorthaired puppies pointing. Like they're like puppies; they're tiny, and yet it looks like an instinctive behavior. Yeah. Nobody's taught them to do it; they just do it.
They're amazing, aren't they? So it just amazes me though, because like I could sniff out chocolate. I could say, I know the chocolate's over there. But I wouldn't kind of go, hey, Lily, the chocolate's over there, you go get it. I'll just wait here. I'll be going, zoom, I'm off to get the chocolate, mate.
I mean, that's the thing about dogs, right? They are so sensitive and responsive to us.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and dog training does wonders.
I often think, though, if something had happened, so we domesticated the cat first instead of the dog, how different would all three species be? How different would humans be? How different would cats be? How different would dogs be? You know, if it had happened that way around, that we'd gone for cats first and then horses and then dogs had sort of, you know, retained their wildness as cats have, kind of thing.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? How different would we all be?
Yes to that question. I guess dogs were much easier than cats. That's why we have so many dog breeds.
I guess so, yeah. I just, it really tickles my brain because cats are small. Well, I suppose the original cats weren't, but like, I don't know. It is something that I think, well, why? Because the wolves would have been as wild as the cats. It just tickles my brain. But I'll stick to the questions I've sent you.
Well, you know, I'm just going to look at a certain page. On page, let's see. Okay, page 42 and 43, pages 42 and 43, predatory murder patterns. So, dogs do a lot of behaviors that wolves do, but they just do them, they're not sort of, they're more flexible with these behavior patterns, these murder patterns.
So it's funny, isn't it? Because you say that dogs are more flexible. Like, I won't say that they're better, kind of thing. But that's praising the dog in a way that they can do. But because often we look at it and we go, well, we've bred out the independence, you know, from the wolf.
But then there are also types of dogs that have retained that independence, like a lot of primitive type dogs have been described as being cat-like. They're less touchy-feely and cuddly as, you know, the more popular pet breeds.
Yes.
They're more independent. Yeah. They might or might not be more predatory. They're more aloof. So there are dogs that are cat-like.
Oh, yes, yeah. I have to say, the first time we met a Shiba Inu, which is quite a small dog, and it was a delightful little dog. And we'd actually pulled them on a caravan site, and this dog was lying outside. And I kind of went, you know, hello. And the dog just kind of looked, but gave no inclination whether it was friendly or not. Jenny was only a child. And they wanted to say hello. And I said, look, I'll go and test the dog before you say hello. And I went over and just sort of sidled up and put my hand out so they could sniff. And they just showed no interest, no aggression, no interest, nothing.
Yeah.
And eventually this dog got to its feet and kind of went, fine, I will meet you if I have to, and came over and was sort of very reluctantly stroked. And then the owner appeared in the doorway, and the dog was a different dog. It was like, oh, I love you, I love you, I love you. So it was very aloof to us strangers.
Yeah. There you go.
I know, they're all different. Sorry, did I cut across your point you were making about page 42 and 3, the wolves?
Oh, no. I can't remember what I was going to say.
I'm sorry, Lily. I think I cut across you. Sorry.
You're talking about wolves.
Yes.
Are the dogs? So dogs are very different from wolves. You know, they don't. They depend on us for food. Like, they've always scavenged for their food, right? That's how they're different from wolves. They find their foods in human communities, and over time they come to become dependent on us to get fed. So, you know, that's how we're bonded. So, you know, I mean, in a way, dogs have domesticated themselves by hanging with us and scavenging for food and, you know, convincing us to feed them, give them. So they're not wolves anymore.
No, luckily, thank goodness for us.
Yeah.
Thank goodness.
Yeah.
Do any of the individual dogs you came across sort of stick in your memory? And what I'm thinking about here is the Fuzzy Monster Truck, a toy Australian Shepherd Chihuahua mix who alerts and brings you to human. They're migraine meds. And that was that jumped out at me because Jenny is on migraine meds. And I just thought, oh, what a sweet little dog. So do any sort of stick in your memory?
So Fuzzy Monster Truck is my friend's dog. Well, I haven't actually met Fuzzy Monster Truck, but, you know, my friend, Evie, she posts a lot of, you know, photos of him. So, you know, it's when I was doing the chapter on assistance dog, he seemed like the perfect model. But a lot of the dogs, like in the end papers, for example, they're all portraits of dogs belonging to friends and family and clients. And all the village dogs in the book, they're actually drawings of real dogs. So I've sort of collected, you know, photos from people I've met on the internet, people I know. So those are special to me. Those drawings are special to me because they're actual dogs.
I bet they're very special to the owners as well. Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah. Wonderful. I have to ask you, are you now planning a Cats of the World book?
Probably not. So we haven't, I mean, we haven't created cat breeds to the same extent that we've done dogs.
No.
And I don't think we would see the sort of extreme differentiation between different types of cats.
Yeah.
I mean, cats look the same. I mean, dogs vary so much, so dramatically in the way they look. We don't have that in cats. And there are cat breeds that look quite extreme, like the smush face cats and the hairless cats and so on. And I think a lot of that kind of breeding is not ethical. They're not actually things. So I'm not sure I want to encourage or promote.
Mm. Yeah.
Cats are sort of perfect the way they've been designed by nature.
Yeah. Yeah. No, they are. They are. As you were saying, there's less variation in cats. I sort of thought, well, cats wouldn't stand for it, would they? Dogs will go, yeah, okay, I'll get bigger or I'll get smaller, I'll fit into your life. Cats will just like, no, I draw the line at that.
Well, my cats are very loving and snuggly, and you know.
Yeah, yeah. Oh no, our cats are lovely, and they snuggle up. But I still think they have times when they go, mm-mm, that thus far and no further.
Yeah, but we love them for their independence. Mm-hmm. We love how they are. We don't want them to be any more dependent on us than they already are.
Yeah. It's just a different relationship, isn't it? As ever, I've got one eye on the time. Is there anything else that you'd like to add that we haven't said yet?
I mean, other than buy the book.
That's fine. That's good. Buy That's valid.
Tell everyone about it. Photos of your dogs with the book, because I love seeing those. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. I can get on. I can do two of those. I can do more. I'll send you some of that. and very importantly, where can people find out more about you online?
Okay. My website is doggiedrawings.net, doggiedrawings.net. And I'm also on Instagram, LILITA_YAYA, and on Blue Sky, Lily Chin, LILICHIN. So
smashing. We'll put all those links on and people can find you. I'm sure lots of people have found you already, but if anybody hasn't found you yet, go and find Lily Chin. She's brilliant.
Thank you so much, Julie.
Cheers. Thank you ever so much. I've really enjoyed that, and I've enjoyed the book, and thank you so much. And when you do the next one, which probably won't be Cats of the World, let me know.
I will. Thank you so much.
Oh, cheers. I wouldn't put Cats of the World past you, though, I think.
Most of them will look the same as the cats.
You'll have to do the characterization differently with them.
Yeah, exactly.
Big thanks to Lily for that interview and for such a fantastic book. We have all the links Lily mentioned at dogcastradio.com, and I do recommend that you follow Lily if you're not already, because she's a fantastic illustrator and a lovely person.
You're listening to Dogcast Radio on www.dogcastradio.com.
Now it's time for the Dogcast Radio news. Talking of dog breeds, as we have been, do you know which are the naughtiest dog breeds? Well, Many Pets, a trusted leader in the pet insurance industry, has released its eagerly anticipated naughtiest dog names and breeds, showcasing the most mischievous four-legged friends. With data sourced from thousands of claims and customer insights, the findings underline Many Pets' expertise in protecting pets and their owners from life's unexpected moments. According to Many Pets' analysis, the top 10 naughtiest dog names of the past year are Luna, Teddy, Bailey, Bella, Max, Buddy. Now, I take exception there, because any dog called Buddy is a saint. Let's carry on. Ruby, Poppy, Molly, Hugo. Whether it's Luna eating a chocolate that was left on the counter or Buddy cutting his paw playing, these names represent a playful spirit that Many Pets and many of us dog owners know all too well. In addition to the names, the report highlights the top breeds most likely to get into mischief, which are Labrador. Again, I take exception. Labradors are saints. Labrador, Cockapoo, French Bulldog, German Shepherd, Cocker Spaniel, Beagle, Siberian Husky, Pug, Dachshund. From Labradors with a penchant for puddles to French bulldogs causing a stir at home, these breeds are known for their lovable yet cheeky antics. Many Pets vet, Dr. Rebecca McMillan, says some of these dogs can have a stubborn or independent streak, whereas others are high energy and will need an experienced owner who can give them plenty of time and attention. With patience and consistency, these dogs can also learn to follow their owner's commands. Dr. Rebecca says that naughty dogs largely need the same approach and training as dogs who are considered well-behaved. Quote, positive rewards-based training is always the best way to teach dogs new behaviours, especially if they're naughty. That means lots of treats, praise and encouragement. Never punishments, raised voices or negative actions. Negative actions always lead to anxiety, fear, mistrust and aggression, which are the exact behaviours owners try to rectify in naughty dogs. Instead, positive actions, like clicker training, can build a strong, positive bond and better relationship between pet and owner. End quote. But if your dog is struggling, Many Pets recommends seeing your vet and a good pet behaviourist to get things sorted out. Many Pets has earned its reputation as a leader in the pet insurance industry by offering tailored policies, exceptional customer service and a deep understanding of the unique needs of pets and their owners. With this latest report, Many Pets continues to demonstrate its commitment to keeping pets happy, healthy and insured, no matter how mischievous they may be. For more information, visit manypets.com. Meanwhile, the Insurance Emporium has been investigating which breeds cost the most and the least. The five most affordable breeds are at number 5, Shih Tzu, 4, Lhasa Apso, 3, Yorkshire Terrier, 2, Jack Russell Terrier, 1, Jack Russell Terrier Cross. While the most expensive breeds are 5, Golden Retriever, 4, French Bulldog, 3, Hungarian Vischler, 2, Labradoodle Cross, 1, German Shepherd. Bear in mind, that ranking is purely to demonstrate which dog breeds work out cheaper to buy and look after versus those which are most expensive. It does not reflect the whole cost of owning a dog. For example, routine vaccinations, flea and tick treatment, neutering, dog grooming, toys and treats, and holiday care. Plus, it does not take into account that your dog may develop a penchant for expensive dog food. And it certainly doesn't take into account the several dog chew toys that will inevitably end up being destroyed within minutes of being brought home. But basically, having a dog is expensive, whatever breed or mix you choose. In other news, Dogcast Radio is 20 years old this year. Our first episode was back in August 2005 and focused on Labradors, of course. It was my Labrador buddy who really opened the door for us to the wonderful world of dogs. How long have you been listening? Which episodes have you particularly enjoyed? Is there anything you'd like to hear about that we haven't covered yet? More on all that coming up. But for now, until next time, look after yourselves and your dogs. Thanks for listening to Dogcast Radio, available from www.dogcastradio.com. That's dogcastradio.com. If you'd like to get in touch with us, and wherever you are in the world, we'd love to hear from you. You can do so in a variety of ways. You can contact us on Skype with the ident Dogcast Radio. That's all one word, Dogcast Radio. By email, you can contact me on julie@dogcastradio.com. When contacting us by email, if you have the facilities, please record your questions or comments and send them to us as an audio file. That way we can include them directly in our programme. We can accept most formats, for example, WAV, MP3. All these methods of contacting us can be found on our website, which is www.dogcastradio.com. Why was the dog such a good storyteller? Because he knew how to pause for dramatic effect.